This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Given all the recent chaos, there was one important story that came out last week about the 2016 election that hardly got a mention. Leaked data revealed in detail how Cambridge Analytica, a political consulting company, targeted more than 3 million Black Americans. According to Channel 4 News in the UK, the firm helped build a program called Deterrence, and the Trump campaign used it to try to persuade these voters to stay home on Election Day, with some success. But the ideas behind Cambridge Analytica's tactics are not new. Historian Jill Lepore says it all began in the late 1950s and involves a company you've probably never heard of. Jill Lepore is a history professor at Harvard University and author of the book If Then, How the Simulmatics Corporation Invented the Future. And she welcomes us and she joins us now. Jill Lepore, it's great to have you on 1A.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So we should just start with the basics. Quickly tell us more about this firm. What was it?
Simulmatics was founded in 1959 to help a Democrat win the White House after two terms of Dwight Eisenhower. The Democrat would be running against his successor, Richard Nixon. And Simulmatics was kind of the Cambridge Analytica of the Cold War from the left, right? It wanted, in fact, to get Democrats to pay attention to Black voters, not to discourage them from voting.
And what convinced the Kennedy campaign to take a closer look at them?
Well, the guy who ran the company, Ed Greenfield, who was an ad man and political consultant from New York, had pulled together really some of the best computer scientists and behavioral scientists in the country to build what they called a people machine that could simulate an election and could predict voting behavior by breaking voters down into voter types. Greenfield and the guys in the company were real proponents of civil rights, and the Democrats, you know, had taken a very weak position on civil rights throughout the 1950s, and there was the Dixiecrat fracture, and a lot of Southern conservatives just really opposed civil rights. The company did a report on Black voters in the North and gave it to the Democratic National Commission. They were commissioned to do that to try to convince them that Black voters really mattered, that Black votes counted. And then when Kennedy got the nomination, the Kennedy campaign hired Simulmatics to provide further election advice, a bunch of things, like including like what he should do about his Catholicism. Should he speak more forthrightly about it?
What were some of the technical challenges they faced early on?
So at the time, the Simulmatics project was the largest social science research project ever conducted, right? Like, they kept talking about how massive their data was. They had hundreds of thousands of records from, they were using census data, public opinion data, and then election returns to make this model of the electorate, a kind of mathematical model of the electorate, and then conduct a computer simulation. You could ask, if Kennedy said this, then voters of this type would do that. And they thought that worked really well. When Kennedy won, they took credit for his victory. But in 1961, the company went public, really kind of augurs all the kinds of ways that tech startups work now. They tried to produce research that they could sell to all kinds of industries, from news organizations to entertainment organizations to manufacturers, promising to predict human behavior. And they, in most of those realms, there just wasn't enough data. If you think about it, voting, like, we have a lot of data. Like, we generate our own data every time we vote. But a lot of those industries just weren't collecting, say, consumer data. So it was really hard to do the kinds of projects that they envisioned. It only became possible, really, in the late 1990s.
Why this book now, Jill?
I myself find myself baffled by what it is that we have, I guess, tacitly or unknowingly agreed to with regard to the collection of personal data about each of us and its use by for-profit corporations to predict our behavior and therefore manipulate our behavior and sell us stuff and try to change our opinions about things, and especially the really pernicious effect that this has had, not only on elections, but on democratic institutions more broadly, including journalism. I just, as a historian, really puzzled by how, like, the sort of slow accretion of acceptance of different kinds of interference in people's decision-making that gets us to where we are now, where so much of, you know, just our experience every day. I mean, kind of say, except for, say, listening to the radio, a lot of what you're doing, you're being directed, and your choices, you know, every time you open up your newspaper, or magazine online, what the stories you're being fed are fed to you and only to you in just such a sequence. As a historian, I just really wanted to know where that came from, and that took me to the Simulmatics Corporation.
Well, very briefly, you mentioned the 480. It was written by Eugene Burdick. How important was he and that work to Simulmatics?
He was asked to join the company. He was a political theorist from UC Berkeley and became really distressed by what the company was doing, so wrote a dystopian novel about it that raised an alarm that this kind of work would eventually undermine democracy itself.
That's Jill Lepore. She's my guest. She's a history professor at Harvard University, and her latest book is called If Then, How the Simulmatics Corporation Invented the Future. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and from Jill Lepore in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Swell. Swell is a place for thoughtful audio conversations that are unlike anything you've experienced. Interact with authors, celebrity chefs, teachers, artists, CEOs, or connect with new people from all over the world. Listen on Swell for fresh ideas and perspectives. And once you're comfortable with the app, start a new conversation by posting a Swell of your own. Swell is free in the App Store and on Google Play. From technologists to podcasters, interesting people are talking on Swell.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
With the unemployment rate at record highs right now, millions of Americans are without health insurance.
This week on Throughline, how our healthcare became tied to our jobs.
And how a temporary solution turned into an everlasting problem.
Listen now to Throughline from NPR, where we go back in time
to understand the present.
We're talking about how big data was first used by political campaigns and how it's been used to shape the way we think of certain candidates and their parties. With us is Jill Lepore. She's a history professor at Harvard University. Her latest book is called If Then, How the Simulmatics Corporation Invented the Future. And a quick correction, Pennsylvania's Republican Senator Pat Toomey has announced his plans to retire at the end of his term in 2022. I misspoke earlier and said 2020. He says he does not plan to run for governor. Instead, he'll return to the private sector. Now, Jill, one of the main characters in this story is Ed Greenfield. Remind us who he is, because he struck me as someone who could have easily been plucked from the screen out of Mad Men.
Yeah, Ed Greenfield was a very slick and sexy, charming Madison Avenue guy, a madman. He ran a political consulting company in the 1950s out of New York, and he was also a very dedicated Democrat and a very staunch civil rights advocate. So he did work on the 1952 presidential campaign and in 1956 for Adlai Stevenson, who was running against Dwight Eisenhower. And he got really frustrated in 56 that Stevenson wouldn't take a stronger position on civil rights. But he was also really, he just was a little bit of an academic hanger-on. He was fascinated by what was going on in academia. And as he was really interested in mainframe computing, which was just like a very thrilling cutting edge thing. I mean, think about the 1950s. 1956 is the year artificial intelligence is coined. People begin, you know, are talking about these giant electronic brains and what they can do. And Greenfield just kind of has this just kind of bolt of lightning insight. I think we could use these giant machines to not just to count the vote, which had been done for the first time on national television in 1952 when CBS used a computer to predict the outcome, but to actually predict the vote before it happened. Mm-hmm. And then he could sell this as advice to political candidates. And in a way, he thought this was just really the only thing that would maybe budge the Democrats away from their, you know, really cowardly position on civil rights.
When you think about Ed Greenfield, are you able to draw a direct line from him to a modern tech leader today? Someone like a Mark Zuckerberg?
So. No, because I think Greenfield was actually... This is going to sound, this is sort of, you know, what would you kind of conventionally call a fully realized human being? I mean, he had a really full life. He was involved in many different realms. He was really a student of American politics. He wasn't just a tech guy. A lot of the presumption in the culture of Silicon Valley and among a certain set of people, you know, advocates of disruptive innovation, is you need to actually not understand something in its history. You need to just go in and kind of blow it up. And that's how you can make a lot of money and do something wholly new, the kind of move fast and break things motto of Facebook. Greenfield was not that guy. He was a real student of democratic institutions and a real lover of the party system and really keen to think about how to get the, you know, party platform to move. This people machine that he pulled together, these incredible scientists together to build, was a device for him to achieve a political end. It wasn't a device that he built and then its political ends would just kind of, who knows, you know, there would be unintended consequences. He, in a way, one of the things that was so interesting about this story is there really aren't villains in it. There are some very well-intentioned, well-meaning people who can't quite see the consequences of their actions. So, you know, this Eugene Burdick, who's the critic of the company who writes the novel about it, really can see it. And he says, you know, in a preface to his book, The 480 in 1964, these people are incredibly well-intentioned, but they have no idea what the implications of this work would be, that they're essentially building a new machine that will be a new underworld in American politics.
Well, let's play a quick clip from Chris Wiley, who worked for the data firm Cambridge Analytica. He was the one who revealed how personal information was taken without authorization in early 2014 to build a system that could profile individual U.S. voters in order to target them with personalized political advertisements. Now, back then, the company was owned by the hedge fund billionaire Robert Mercer and co-founded by Donald Trump's key advisor Steve Bannon. Here's how Chris Wiley summed up his regret in an interview with The Guardian.
You are playing with an entire country, the psychology of an entire country, without their consent or awareness. And not only are you like playing with the psychology of an entire nation, you're playing with the psychology of an entire nation in the context of the democratic process.
So as I said, you document some of the pushback to Simulmatics at the time. But what did we forget between Simulmatics and the Cambridge Analytica scandal that blew up 50 years later?
Yeah, I mean, something that I think is really important about the Simulmatics story is the way it reveals that so much of this research goes very far back, and in fact goes back to the Cold War, and was part of a psychological warfare campaign. I mean, if you think about it, the work that Wiley is talking about, that is to say, to sort of reduce human beings to demographic entities on whom particular messages can be tried and targeted to change their opinions about things, that is what psychological warfare is, right? So, interrupt your thinking, distract you, destroy your attention, send you a message, try to manipulate behavior, see if that works, you know, do a test on that, and if that works, send you more messages. That's what psychological warfare is, and that's what somehow we have agreed to have, you know, executed on us pretty much all day long by corporations who are selling us stuff, by political campaigns that are trying to change our ideas, by media organizations that are only sending us certain content. And I think there really are real questions. How did something that was designed to win an ideological warfare war against communism come to be used indiscriminately and ubiquitously as part of doing business and part of winning an election? You can see some really important turns in the 1960s where people keep saying, stop, 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 this is a very bad idea. But no one, it's hard for ordinary people to understand it, and you can see too where it's hard for Congress to understand it. Much as, you know, there are these kind of infamous congressional hearings where, you know, Orrin Hatch says, I don't understand, to Mark Zuckerberg, like, how do you guys even make money? And Zuckerberg says, well, we're selling ads. But that's not the least of it. And even in the 1960s, when Congress held hearings about this stuff, you can see, reading the transcripts, members of Congress really don't understand what's going on. It's very difficult for them to have the capacity. They're not being briefed well. So at a time in the 60s when guardrails could have been put up, when safeguards could have been built, when there could have been rules and regulations, they're not built. Well, and that's worth reexamining and thinking through.
Well, what I hear you saying is that a misunderstanding or a lack of understanding about the technology made it more difficult for politicians at the time to grapple with the ethics of this data collection. Is that a fair way of summing it up?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could make, you know, to your question, how do you get from the Cold War to Facebook, there are two stops you could make. One would be in the 1960s, think of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, right, which is a very data-driven set of government programs. So the Johnson administration needed to collect a lot of data about people in order to implement, you know, the Voting Rights Act or the Equal Opportunity Commission's requirements. And they proposed establishing a national data center like the Library of Congress or the National Archives that would hold the federal government's data. But there was so much conservative pushback against the Great Society and against Johnson and that those kind of government programs, that proposal was defeated, which, you know, was maybe really the last time the government could have established really meaningful, deep rules about data collection. But there's so much fear of big government that defeated it. Then by the time, the next place you might stop is the 1990s with 1996 and the Telecommunications Act that is pretty much drafted by Newt Gingrich coming out of the Contract with America, that is a kind of, Bill Clinton signs it, Al Gore advocates for it, that sets up a completely unregulated world of internet exchange, right? That was the next really good opportunity to think about what would it mean for people to be collecting information about people who, now are reduced to users. And that was also pretty much abandoned and run over by a conservative political agenda, really not even a conservative, but a libertarian political agenda that brought together a lot of, Stuart Brand and other kind of tech advocates of a completely free internet who had, were coming from the far left, and then, Gingrich from the far right. And what they agreed about was there should be no rules on the internet.
Well, we have a lot more to talk about with my guest, Jill Lepore, and we'll do just that right after a short break. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Talkspace. Your mental health is priceless, but getting support shouldn't cost a fortune. At a fraction of the cost of in-person therapy, Talkspace connects you to a licensed therapist you can message with 24/7 from the privacy of your mobile device. So you get the support you need at a price you can afford. Get $100 off your first month with promo code 1A at Talkspace.com or when you download the app.
Radio Ambulante is NPR's only Spanish language podcast. Listen for stories you won't hear anywhere else, told by the voices that make Latin America come alive. Each week, we bring you another remarkable story that will surprise and move you. Radio Ambulante, new episodes every Tuesday. Listen and subscribe.
This is 1A, and we're talking with historian and author Jill Lepore about the fascinating history of how data has been used and abused for political ends. Jill, before we went to break, I wanted to ask you, do you think part of this is also just a basic misunderstanding or maybe a lack of foresight around how valuable that data would be eventually?
I don't know. I mean, Greenfield was a smart guy, and even he could see in 1959 when he writes his first proposal for this company that this could be, this is a gold mine. Mm-hmm. Simulmatics goes public in 1961. The stock does extremely well. The promise in the stock offering is we're going to use computer technology to predict human behavior. And, the only hitch then for him really was there just wasn't enough data to make those predictions. The mine was pretty decent. The computers were slow, but you could take your time doing it. It's really just a question of collecting the data. So I think canny people could see all along that was a possible outcome. I think what the lesson that people take from Simulmatics after the Kennedy campaign, after Kennedy wins in November of 1960 and Simulmatics takes public credit, the Kennedy campaign denounces, they deny that they've even ever heard of the company. And what happens after that is that people begin to sell these services and to make a lot of money off of doing it, even if they can't do it especially well, but they won't take public credit for it. Like, it kind of goes underground. Like, the lesson is, if you want to run a data mining company that offers predictive analytics to political candidates and corporations, you should keep your mouth shut, because the public doesn't like to hear about that, because the public will be outraged. And that's more what happened than that it didn't work so well.
You said the lesson learned is that if you want to do data mining, the important thing is to, not talk about it, but then that makes it invisible to everyday consumers, which makes it more difficult for us as individuals, as citizens, to advocate for ourselves. And I'm just curious, when you hear from companies like Facebook about, what they're doing to try to control the exploitation of data we give them or data they've harvested, how sincere do you feel their efforts are at this point?
I don't dispute that there are incredibly good people that work at Facebook. It's a big company, a lot of people doing a lot of different kinds of things. I think the leadership is utterly insincere. I think that take the money and run, we'll deal with the consequences. I mean, anyone who watched the hearings this summer whereas Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos and the guy from Google were all talking to Congress. You know, it's a travesty when Zuckerberg says, you know, sir, we're in the business of connecting people to the people that they love. It's just simply not true. That's not a business model. the business model of Facebook is extracting data from people and selling it to third parties so that they can influence you. Like, the consequences of Facebook have been to nearly destroy journalism, to deeply undermine civic institutions, to alienate people from their political communities, in their local communities, and to fundamentally disrupt American politics. And much of that, sure, is I would say all of it is unintended. Much of it was not easy to anticipate. But a great deal of it could have been anticipated, and that's, you know, one of the lessons of the story. You go back and you read what, say, newspaper editors wrote in the days after Simulmatics claimed credit for Kennedy's victory, and most of them say, okay, let's think about this for a little while. Walk this through. Like, I'm going to imagine what's going to happen if we do this for decades. So it's not just like one candidate will have a people machine, but then all candidates will have people machines, and then pretty much the voters don't matter. It's just kind of a battle of who has the most money to buy the best computers to get the election result that they're looking for, not least by dominating media stories, because the media will eventually be contorted in the same direction. You know, if people in 1961 could figure this out and predict it, what's really the excuse for Facebook for not thinking through the consequences of its work?
Well, 50 years from Simulmatics, do you think we're any closer to regulation of this kind of data mining?
I do think actually regulation is inevitable. I think, as you suggest, the invisibility of this kind of manipulation of voters and consumers is an obstacle to it. You know, you read a lot of exposés where, you know, like a tech reporter will say, I followed myself for a 24-hour period and saw what was collected about me, and here's the trail that I left behind. I think more of that kind of work needs to be done so that things can be rendered visible. You know, a lot of reforms that need to happen with regard to writing our political arrangements seem impossible right now. Things are in such disarray. There's such an incredible, just like a cascade of chaos going on. But I also think about, you know, the day, you know, I walked home from school and heard that the Berlin Wall fell. You know, things do change. This is like the Berlin Wall. Like, this is a phenomenal disruption of humanity's capacity to live a good life. And I was just sitting here before we got on the phone reading the Pope's newest encyclical. Like, I think that there are voices that will be heard and there will be change that will come.
But there's part of me, the cynical side of me, that says, you know, like, this genie it's out of the bottle. And can we ever really get it fully back in?
I'm not gonna stand down on cynicism. Like, I'm with you on the cynicism. Part of it is, you know, I have a commitment to say I have to believe this can change. But I also, it's not a genie. You know, it's a bunch of money-making corporations that have to be, you know, licensed by the federal government, that, you know, have to be given a free pass by Congress that continues to give them a free pass. Like, it's well within the power of voters to make decisions that urge legislators to make other decisions. Like, we're not helpless in the face of this. These people aren't gods and priests. These are just guys.
So just in the last minute or so we have here, if there was one thing that could happen today that would help us all feel better about who does what with our data, for you, what would it be?
I think that there got to be an awful lot of leadership from the four kind of big tech companies about voting. There was a great New York Times editorial last week that asked, what will these companies do on election day if the Trump campaign tweets that it's won before the voting is over? And it was pretty clear from the response that those companies don't have a plan. What if they showed us a plan? What if they said, it's actually not up to us. We're gonna back out. We're not gonna be available that day. We're not going to interfere. And the only way we know to not interfere is
Jill's line just dropped, but I think we could all sense where she was going. That was Jill Lepore, a history professor at Harvard University, author of the new book, If Then, How the Simulmatics Corporation Invented the Future. Today's producer was James Morrison. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.